Accession number 9437, reel 13.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 13. Going back as you did in 1978, were the achievements of the Chinese Communists very obvious?
Yes, there were many changes and a different tempo. We'd been back in 74 and the Chinese were still very much self-contained and inward-looking. They didn't seem to be interested in what was going on in the West at all, or in how they compared themselves in any way with the West. When I mentioned to someone that the Great Wall was the only man-made edifice that was visible from the moon, the Chinese weren't interested at all. When I showed them a Hong Kong newspaper to the interpreter, who I thought would have lapped up any literature in English, he just glanced at it and put it down on one side as if he shouldn't read any of this decadent material from the West. That was in 74. In 78, people were far freer, far more outward-looking. They'd obviously were at a turning point in a way, in that at last they had a surplus. And I felt very much that they were at a very critical stage, because how they used that surplus would shape their destiny. And how wise they've been, I don't know. I haven't been back since. But it was extraordinary. The changes between 74 and 78, I felt, were almost as great as they had been from 48 to 74. Of course, the Cultural Revolution had come in between and really set them back in a grotesque way.
Yes, did you see the effects of that in 74? Because it would have been the tail end of it.
It was the tail end of it, and we did have contact with people who'd been imprisoned and sent to the country and so on, but people were very, very loath to discuss it and talk about it.
Any of your doctors, were they affected by it?
Dr. Li Bing, I know, had been sent out to work in the country, and she made very light of it, but she didn't want to discuss it. Other people had friends, non-Chinese friends, who'd been involved, and they were also extremely reluctant to talk about the time they'd been away from home. And there were strange stories going around. Nevertheless, there were lots of goods to be bought in the shops, and a few girls had perms, and there were a few more coloured clothes about than there had been. But still, there were lots and lots of the khaki uniforms of soldiers, and most people wore grey or except children, wore grey or dark blue or the plain colours and sort of uniform-type clothes that we'd really seen before in the under the communists. When we went back in 78, it was summertime, I must admit, but almost everyone had some coloured clothes. And things were seemed much freer.
Did you go back to Yan'an?
Yes, we had. We went there in 74 as well, but we were somehow things were freer in 78. I remember in the guest hotel where we were staying, we asked the cook if he could make xiaomi, the millet porridge that we'd had so often when we'd lived there with the tree dates in. I don't think I mentioned tree dates before. They're like very inferior palm dates, not nearly so sweet and succulent. But we used to have this millet porridge with tree dates in, and the cook was so thrilled that foreigners could ask for something that's so very Chinese. And so we were very much welcomed as old friends, and shops were specially open for us to go to that were really only... they weren't the tourist shops, they were shops for the Chinese. And there's a wonderful, a very good museum there, but I think their cataloguing system must have been pretty much at fault, because when we presented them with some photographs then and asked about photographs we'd left in 72, they hadn't the faintest idea where the earlier ones were. And but nevertheless, the museum is very, very well set out, very interesting, about the rise of communism and Mao Zedong and the Long March and so on, and I can't remember if there were archaeological specimens there or whether it was other places we saw them. And somewhere also there was a marvellous model of the Yellow River showing how the silt, it's one of the heaviest silted river in the world. And
was Yunnan a special place
there? Oh, absolutely. Particularly in 74, it was more of a Mao shrine than it was when we were there in 78. They were quite horrified that we didn't want to visit every single place that Mao had lived in the valleys. I think we visited two, if not three, and they were quite sad when we said we didn't really want to visit the other six or so. But there's the museum and other places that are dedicated to the rise of the communists. The changes in the valleys, I mentioned way back about seeing these cisterns on top of the mountains, but in 74 there was the most fantastic apple crop there. They'd planted all these apple orchards because of the irrigation, and they were storing the apples just in caves dug in the hills, great big ones. See, and I said, but don't they all go off and you're just left with a lot of cider? Well, they said it wasn't, but I really can't see how that can have been very satisfactory. And at that time, transport was one of China's main problems, because although the production had been vastly increased, the transport system hadn't grown enough to cope with the extra production. And I think there must have been a lot of waste. I'm sure those apples would have been wasted. A lot of them would have been wasted. I think by 84, things were 78, things were better sorted out, and they were coming to grips with the basic problems much better. But Yunnan had factories and clothing factories. It was quite a big place. Nevertheless, it has no importance except that it is a Mao shrine. That part of the country, even though they have increased production so much, it's unless they find coal or oil, which may well be there, because there were small coal mines way back, it will be of no importance.
Were people still living in caves?
Oh, yes.
The traditional life's all
gone. In Yunnan, they had electricity, of course, which they hadn't had before. You could see wires draped all over the place. But the caves were just the same, because really they are absolute excellent homes. I mean, they're cool in summer and warm in winter. And
good enough to have a baby in.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, well, particularly if they did what they did for us and made the fire outside, you see, so we didn't have the actual fire in the cave. They made the fire outside and put a hole through the wall. If like that, they're absolutely wonderful. And even with a stove inside, they're really very comfortable.
Could I ask you now about the relationship of your pacifism to the Chinese situation? Here you were sort of operating in a situation of civil war, really, wasn't it?
Yes.
Mm. Were there any dilemmas for you in this situation?
I think because it was a civil war and we were in no... Well, I suppose we were taking sides because we were helping the communists, but we were quite willing to help the nationalists that came to the hospital. And I think if we'd been in nationalist China, we would have also helped the soldiers there when they were injured. I didn't feel there was really a dilemma. Of course, we admitted the existence of war. We weren't being out-and-out pacifists. But I never felt any sense of dilemma. I felt we were there to serve whoever needed our attention and who was in a position to benefit from anything we could give them.
It's interesting you mentioning, you know, the fact that you weren't really neutral in this situation. You went to Yunnan, didn't you, in order to be impartial to both sides.
Yes.
But did you find that, you know, you were on the side, if one can put it as crudely as that, that you thought perhaps one regime was better than another for the people?
Well, I think we when we were in nationalist China, we'd seen quite enough examples of impartiality and corruption. And we realised that the communists were not corrupt. There was not nepotism. There was a fair treatment of all levels of society and... I wouldn't like to say all creeds, because I'm sure there were prejudices, but certainly the average person had a comparatively square deal from the communists, which they certainly didn't from the nationalists. And the communists were working not for their gain, but for the country's gain, the people's gain as a whole.
You were also coping with the effects of war, weren't you?
Absolutely.
The devastation on the countryside, the people and the soldiers.
Mind you, it was a very low-key type of war where we were. The armament they had was very, very antiquated and ineffective. It wasn't... it was like a little skirmish. It wasn't like war had been in the West or even in Burma and so on. I suppose that softened it a bit. Of course, it was war, but on a very low-key, small.
Did you emerge from the China situation, though, as a convinced pacifist still?
Oh, yes.
Was your pacifism reinforced by it?
I don't know about reinforced. Well, it certainly wasn't. Well, nothing was taken away from it. The basic principles were definitely there.
You mentioned earlier, in another context, that you didn't think the pacifists in China had faced dangers similar to the dangers that troops had faced in the war. But surely some of the situations you were in were very potentially dangerous, weren't they?
Yes, but then, I suppose partly as a woman, and partly because we were foreigners, I didn't feel we were in the same sort of position as troops would have been.
How about FAU in different situations in China?
Well, I mentioned the one occasion when a convoy was captured by bandits, which was a bit tricky, and they had to be rescued by... Well, they were rescued by troops. There weren't many situations of that type that arose when we felt we had any difficulty in deciding what the course of action should be. And I think it would have been difficult if, when we were working with the communists, we had been captured by the nationalists. That would have been difficult, I suppose. But nevertheless, I think being with our British and American passports, we would probably have been all right. At least I had the faith in that. I don't think we would ever have been in a really dangerous situation. The only time when it would have been dangerous would have been from some sort of accident, unintentional injury. Or that's how I felt.
The China convoy, you know, when you hear of the China convoy, it seems to have a sort of special image.
Oh, it has, yes. I mean, we went out too late to have been part of that. But certainly anyone who was really a member of the China convoy is somebody quite special. They have a sort of aura that is something different, yes.
But did you not think of yourself as being part of the China
convoy? Well, I felt we had got there rather late. Most of the people that had been in the original convoy and had done a lot of the transport work right away at the beginning had gone by the time we got there. But they really had used tremendous initiative and courage to do what they did. I mean, just the driving was really fantastic. And the whole setup with the war raging with the Japanese at that time, must have been very different. And certainly the people, with the difficulties they had to overcome, had something that we never quite acquired.
Were you pleased, though, to have served in China?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes, it was wonderful.
How about your connection with the peace movement today? Do you have anything to do with it?
Very little. When the children were growing up, we never had any connection with anything at all.
Are you still a pacifist?
Yes, yes, though, as I say, not an active one. I find, when I look at CND and things like this, I feel I can't quite align myself with everything they have in mind, although in so many organisations there's something that I think is very important. And it upsets me sometimes when people talk as if pacifism is so ridiculous or wrong. And I wonder, I really haven't, stood up and been counted, which I'm trying to decide still. I'm uncertain about exactly where I do stand.
Do you think the fact that nuclear weapons have been developed has sort of altered the situation at all, even distorted it?
Yes, I think it's distorted it very much. I mean, it's no longer sort of man-to-man. And, I mean, the Vietnam War, with the things that were expected to be done there and the effect it had on the participants, has brought a new dimension to war. And, of course, nuclear weapons, again, make the whole situation so different. One tiny action can have such devastating results that it's really quite different from what your war used to be, when there were rules that most people kept to. Now, those rules have quite gone, and you've got a new set of standards to think about, and you've got to decide. You've got a new set of right and wrongs to consider.
Do you think, though, that it could be the case that people are more anti-bomb than anti-war today?
Yes, I think so. Yes, because with so many people, patriotism and war go hand in hand. And there aren't very many people who think internationalism is really what should pertain. And it's difficult to, you know, you like to have a pride in your country, and yet in some ways I feel that doesn't seem right.
That you should have a wider view.
A wider view, yes.
Well, we've certainly had a very wide view today, I think, and thank you very much indeed, Elizabeth Hughes.
I'd like to finish with this poem written by my husband in one of those long, icy winter evenings in when we were in it with MT19. If you are tired of life and need a change of scene, if you are worn and pale with cockeye in your spleen, if the food you eat just makes you feel a little sick, with your coffee, milk and butter and the treacle spread on thick, if you need a plainer diet, bought of eatables so rare, such as mento, millet, shaomi, and dates beyond compare, if you sleep at modest hours, if your roommates make a noise, if the servants bang their buckets and wake up all the boys, if the hostel rooms are draughty, if the coal gives off much smoke, if the FSU is poor now, if you yourself are broke, if your pool finds many outlets, the flicks, the girls, the food, if overcrowded tram cars, conductors' surly moods, and busy streets and noisy men, all bent on worrying you, make life too complicated, with restful moments few, do this, my son. If the women at the laundry beat holes in your newest gown, and the warden says your socks are lost, were they blue or white or brown? If the meeting of the section every Friday night at 7 go on and on and on and on until it's near past 11, if the scenery around you jars on your seething brain, and your monthly pool, of which so little now remains, precludes a trip to far Peking or other nearby points, or e'en a meal at Shanghai's most inexpensive joint, if the organising members into relief and other teams and allocation of money to projects and to schemes, if balancing the books brings trouble in its wake, and expense per man per day analysis to make just serves to make you dream of quieter, brighter skies, with worries few to trouble you, and these of micro size, do this, my son. If you would like to sleep from 6 p.m. each day to 7 o'clock the coming morn, and have nobody say that you're a lazy slug and your bones will soon decay, that your arteries will harden and duly fall away, if you regard a suit of clothes which may be rather big, of cotton cloth, both coarse and blue, as daily ideal rig, with cotton padding making you into a teddy bear, and people pointing, saying, there's Wigerin in there. If you enjoy the climate of snow and ice and cold, with frozen streams to slide upon, if you will be so bold, and no temptations asking you to spend your hard-earned wealth, and have a doctor with you to guard your daily health. If you would like to lead a life quite different from the mob, though there will be no guarantee that you will find a job, do this, my son. Join MT19. There are just one or two references there to things you might not understand. There are just one or two words that you may not understand. Manto is steamed bread. Xiaomi is millet, a cereal eaten in the northwest China, like rice. It's what we give budgerigars over here. Pool is the pocket money the FAU members were paid, which was about £1.50 a month. Wigerin means a foreigner, that means a non-Chinese. The reference at the end, that there not being any, you might not be able to find a job, The technical people on MT19, the non-medical technical people, found it very difficult to find work to do because there simply weren't any technical things that they could get equipment to do anything with. I think that gives quite a good idea of what being in MT19 was like.
Thank you very much. One thing that has just struck me, your financial situation. You know, you were a young married couple. When you returned to the UK to set up home, did you have any money, you know, after these years abroad?
Well, no. My husband had a job to go back to, but we'd really had no money like an army gratuity or anything like that.
What had you earned in China?
Well, really nothing. I bought a fur coat, which cost about as much as a wool coat would have done in England. I don't think we had much more.
Were you getting a weekly...
we got this monthly £1.50.
That was, or, that,
or
that
whatever
was the
it
whole
was.
Thing.
I can't remember
but
exactly how much it was.
But what was happening when you were in the Yan'an?
They did save that up. That's why I was able to buy this coat in Peking. It was
a mistake,
actually.
That would have been all your money, would it?
That was all our money, yes, yes. Yes, don't buy a fur coat if you're going to carry a baby because it slips off.
I must remember that.
Yes.